So banking as a service actually is a way banks exposes their services, right, to businesses, or the way banks allow businesses to offer banking solutions to the business's customers. The fact that I can extend a service, the fact that I can bank customers without spending so much in banking them, right? Regulation itself is not supposed to be the problem. It is more around how regulation is being introduced in this climate, in this part of the world. Great products are great because people are ready to part ways with their money. No matter how innovative you are, if your innovation is not solving people's problems, they're not going to pay for it. Build good products, build great products, but above all, look out for ways to solve real problems. Your product can either be a painkiller or a vitamin. Hi, my name is Isaac Durote, a Buzz and API Product Manager, and you're listening to the Spotlight Podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Spotlight. This podcast is for curious minds and aspiring innovators who are leading the charge in the research revolution. We dive deep to discuss inspiring, informative, and offbeat conversations on product research and strategy. My name is Iwadola Shobowale, and I'm a product research and strategy lead at a leading technology company in Nigeria. Guys, we are on our 15th episode. I'm so excited. I read something recently about how most podcasts don't even make it to 15 episodes. So well done to us. Thank you so much for all your feedback. If you have any suggestions on topics we can cover, people we can speak to, please, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn. My name is Iwadola Shobowale again. There's also a form in the show notes that you can fill if you have questions for me. I'll be really happy to answer. If this is your first time listening, the Spotlight Podcast is a platform dedicated to exploring the multifaceted world of business, technology, and innovation. Through in-depth interviews with industry experts, thought leaders, and trailblazers, the podcast aims to unearth valuable insights and share inspiring stories. So please follow us on Instagram and Twitter at _thespotlightpod. You can also follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and I think I'm on TikTok now, making some videos, 1 minute videos on a series called The Productive Minutes. Very interesting, guys. Please follow me, follow the podcast. So let's get into today's episode. So today we are in for an insightful chat with Isaac Durotoye, a tech whiz. And I wish I put that whiz there, who's been quietly shaping the fintech and product management landscape. Isaac has a degree in computer science and a knack for building exceptional products. His journey is through product, banking as a service, and embedded banking, and it's been both inspirational and practical. Isaac's experience from co-founding Product Manager Africa to leading product teams at various financial institutions has given him a deep understanding of the fintech ecosystem, API strategies, and the nuances of effective product management. He's also a prolific writer, sharing his insights on his blog, an amazing blog, by the way, blog.juniorjose.org. So today we're delving into the nuts and bolts of fintech, discussing API ecosystems, product management, best practices, and more. Isaac's wealth of experience in product management, fintech, and API landscapes promises to make this episode an insightful and engaging one. So welcome to the Spotlight Podcast, Isaac. I'm so glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Iwa.
And Isaac is sacrificing like 2 hours of his public holiday. We're meant to be celebrating Independence Day, maybe going out to carry, you know, his family out or something. Now he has entered this studio with me to record. Thank you so much, Isaac.
You're welcome.
Awesome. So first off, we'll get into the icebreaker. I have a couple of questions for you so that we can warm up a bit. So not hard. Let me see. I think I put one hard one, Sha. You know, because I think you're capable. I've read your blog. You're capable of answering hard questions. Let me start easy. Let me start easy. Are you an early bird or a night owl?
Always a night owl. Night forever.
So it's in the night that my eye would have been shining and I can relate, sure.
Yeah.
Awesome. So do you prefer paperbacks or ebooks when you're reading?
I think I prefer both. I do both, right?
Okay.
When I want to be serious, I do paperbacks. When I want to just quickly grab knowledge here and there, I do ebooks.
Okay. Okay. Cool. For me, I don't know. I think ebooks mostly because I like taking notes digitally and then I like going back to refer. If it's a paperback, how do I easily like search? So that's really my main problem. Okay, the next thing, Android or iOS?
Please, I'm a Google fanboy. Android forever.
Are you serious? Yeah, you're the first person on podcast. I'm so happy. Okay, so tell us why. Tell us why.
Okay, so generally, I'm a big fan of Larry Page, personally. Yeah. I'm a fan of Larry Page, personally. And I've always followed the journey of Google right from almost inception. I joined the journey of Google like 2002, right? And I've been following them up to date. I love a lot of things. I really love a lot of things they're up to. They might not necessarily be the very best, but hey, please give them some slack. In fact, I love Google so much. I use their phones. I use a lot of their gadgets for my day-to-day. Yeah.
How's the Pixel 3T? Which of them do you have?
I have a 2, I have a 6. Okay, I currently use a 2 and a 6, right? Okay. I'm waiting for, is it October 4 announcement to pre-order 8?
You don't waste time.
Nah.
Okay. Awesome. What do you use the 2 for? As you respond for work or something?
Yeah, still work. I use it for a day-to-day call, like about phone, easy PC things. Yeah, my 6 is for, you know, pictures. Mm-hmm. They have some very interesting features. So like, I just love the whole AI thing that comes with the 6. I refuse to upgrade to 7 because the hardware upgrade for me is not up to yet. And again, because 6 was the introduction of their Tensor processor. Right. I feel 7 will perfect it, right? But 8 will perfect it more. So let me just wait and have something way more awesome. Yeah. So that's why I'm waiting for.
I feel you on that. Okay. Please dash me your 6 when you're upgraded to the 8.
No problem.
Awesome. Okay. So do you prefer remote work or in person?
Remote forever, please.
Are you currently working remotely?
I do hybrid. I do both remote and on-premise. But what I've noticed is when I go to the office, I'm not work productive. I'm socially productive and I get quicker insights than when I'm working remotely. However, when I need to do call, like when I need to deliver, right? When I need to do what I call deliverance,
focus,
right? I focus remotely. I stay home.
Yeah. I feel you on that. So I wanted to point out something. This is how you know a fintech group. I asked, are you in remote work? Are you working remotely or in person? You said you're working on premise. This is how they know you're a fintech bro. Oh, gosh. Awesome. Yeah. Okay, so let me just ask you 2 more questions. Which do you think holds more potential for future growth, web apps or mobile apps?
It depends on what you want to do, right? Okay. For what I do. Web apps, but generally when it comes to consumer products, right? Consumer products any day, anytime is going to be mobile.
Mm.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't build consumer products. Unfortunately.
Okay. Does that mean you would like to?
Nah.
I feel like you're in a great space. Yeah.
I've tried it once. It's too stressful. It's too stressful for my liking.
But if you ask consumer people too, they'll be like, business as a service, everybody is going to be in sales, basically. Is that true, by the way?
No, not necessarily. Okay. So the good thing about what I do, so by the way, is I do a lot of, I build more of infra. I build a lot of API products. Mm. So the good thing about it is I have fewer people, right? I have fewer stakeholders to actually cater for. And by catering for those fewer stakeholders, I have this multiplication effect. So if I can solve a particular engineer's problem, that engineer in reverse is going to build something that thousands or millions of end users will use. So why do I need to put my effort in the thousands and millions of users when I can solve the person's problem to solve millions of people?
So you're basically solving the source.
The secret is this. I'm a lazy guy. I'm a very lazy boy. So I'm lazy. I love to do small things and get big results.
So I heard this thing. I think they said lazy people are the ones you want working or something, because they will always find the cheapest and the shortest and fastest way to get things done.
And more importantly, very efficient. And more importantly, efficient.
Efficient. True, true. Love it. Awesome. Okay. So in the this final question here. In the fintech sector, do you see regulatory compliance as a hindrance to innovation, or do you think it can actually drive innovation by setting boundaries?
That's dicey. If I answer this question and my compliance guys hear me, I think by tomorrow when I get to the office, they would they'll call a panel for me. But anyways, I'll still say it's always innovation before compliance. So here's the truth, right? Regulation would only play a catch-up. Regulation cannot play anything better than a catch-up. It's always a catch-up. So for me, innovation first, then regulations later.
I think I would agree with that. I didn't think of it that way, because actually regulation cannot go before innovation. It's when things have happened, it can only react, right? That is very insightful.
That's why they are regulating. They are regulating what's existing.
True. Yeah. That's very insightful. Yeah. Isaac, you guys, can you see that he's very smart? Please run to his blog. He's sharing free insights there. Seriously, he's really smart. Honestly, all right, the next thing we'll do, Isaac, I would love for you to introduce yourself in your own words. Tell us what you want us to know about you. What do you do? Who are you?
Who is Isaac? Isaac is Isaac Durotoye, right? And I run blog.jnrjose.org, right? That's my blog, where I write mostly around, I write a lot about API products and API product strategy. I also write a lot about banking as a service, right? And everything in between. Outside of that, I think Isaac is a semi-quiet but very playful guy, right? I'm very playful, and I love, also a nerd. I think I'm a nerd, right? Isaac is a nerd. And fun fact will remain that I think I got introduced to tech. Okay, I wrote my very first line of code in 1999. That's a very fun fact. Long ago. I wrote my very first lines of code. The same day I know how to create variables, and I wrote a simple calculation, a program to do some basic calculation, right?
Please, how old were you at that time?
I think I was, what age was I? I was 12.
Wow. So did you know what you were doing, or you were just like, what's this stuff? Let me just try it.
No. I knew what I was doing, actually. My sister used to code in Basic and Pascal that year.
Oh, wow.
Yes, she used to write codes in Basic and Pascal, right? Then she introduced me. She taught me how to write Basic programming. Then 2002, I started my full tech journey proper in 2002.
Can you hear me?
2005, I delve more into the CompTIA side of things, the A plus, the N plus, and S plus side of things. And 2007, all these times I was in uni yet. Anyways, 2007, I started studying network engineering, but my network engineering is more around Microsoft related stuff, systems engineering, systems administration, database administration and management, right? Yeah. So eventually, before I went into university, to now study computer science proper.
Amazing stuff. Thank you. So anybody that wants to get to where Isaac is, he has given you a roadmap of his life. By age 12, you have to write your first line of code.
If you are not necessarily.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. So the next thing I would love for you to share is how you got into, so, I mean, you told us how you got to study computer in, science, right? So from there to where you are now, what was that like?
Okay, so the first time, so I call myself more like a lucky or an accidental manager, right? Back in the uni, in my 400 level, my 400 level in uni, there's this challenge my uni had. I actually went to one of those private universities where the school had some major challenge with the regulators. That's the university commission. And one of the conditions for the school to actually get back on track properly was for them to digitize some of their manual processes, right? 400 level computer science student, the school was looking for a solution at all costs. So they came to the department, talked with the HOD of computer science that time. And the HOD recommended a couple of students, and I was one of them. So, and the other person that was nominated had already graduated. So we're just two, actually. And the other person was nominated, so I graduated. I don't really like programming like that. I never feel, fun fact again, I never had B in any of my programming courses in school. Always had A. Machine language. There's a course we had at time called machine language. Man, that was difficult when I didn't offset and stuff like that. Right? So, but even at that, I don't really love programming like that. I don't see myself being a software dev. Right. So I played the role of the product manager, tried to understand the manual process, tried to document, tried to understand how people are currently using and how they are solving their current problems. Then my other guy that was nominated was one that I translated everything to an engineer's and terminologies, and he was able to build the application. So that's how we started. Mm-hmm. That's how I started product management. Unfortunately or fortunately, I didn't even know that there is anything in this life called product management, right? Then until after my service year, when I got my first role as a product manager. Wow. This is what I want to do.
How?
Okay, so it's a long story too, right? Before I finished service, I got my first job back in Lagos. So I think I came back from service on a Friday-ish. Then the following Monday, I resumed my new job. It was stressful.
You didn't even give yourself
literally, I got the job in December. No, I got the job first week of January, I think. I finished service end of February, right? And immediately. So they were waiting for me to finish service.
Okay,
finished service and come and resume. So I go back and I resume my job. But again, I wasn't enjoying the job per se, right? Because that's not what I came for. Then, so one of my classmates started a small company right that time, and we all came together and what will we be doing in the company? They're like, okay, let's do this. So it was in the process of looking for a job title that was going to be assigned to me, let me put it that way, right? That the whole product management thing comes up. Like, oh, this actually fits perfectly for what I am able to do and what I am known for. But that's how I started my product management journey, right? And I was there for about 2 years plus. Almost about 2 years plus each.
Fantastic stuff. Would you say being a product manager is harder now than your first role?
No, I think it's getting better by the ways. My first role, I was a product manager by title, not by training. Right? So it was a little bit, there's some decisions I was making or were making it out of instinct, not out of
frameworks
or standards or processes, right? So like, I think this is what these people, but I think one thing we were doing right that time was we go to our client. Sometimes we go to the office and spend like a week. We sit with them and we see them use our product. arrive there and there. Interesting enough, I'll be there. The engineer will be there because we're not plenty in the company actually. Maybe like four or five of us, but myself and the engineer, the founder of the company is actually an engineer, right? So myself and the engineer would sit in the company. In our client's office. Every day we resume there and we close with them sometimes. And you see them use it. Whatever problem they have, we'll fix it right there and there. And we move on. We fix it right there and there and we move on. So we're able to build a product that was actually adopted in about four or five states. Interesting enough, fun fact. So somebody saw our product and really loved it. The person had a contract with federal government to build some entrepreneurial products. We built it for this company and they took it to the US and the product was awarded the most innovative entrepreneurial product for social institutions. Yeah, like my God, we did it.
All the hard work, all the deals, watching people use the product. Wow.
Watch people use the product. So but now I think it's better. I did not really know what to listen to, what to hear, right? What to watch.
You just do everything they ask for.
I just do everything they ask for. But nowadays I know what to watch out for. I know my role, I know my customer's role, I know better stakeholder management, you know, and stuff like that. So I think it's easier now, yeah.
Fantastic. I love that. I actually like the fact that you explained, you know, the difference. I really like that. You said something and I watched something recently. Do you know Chloe Shi? She's a product manager. I think she's at Discord. She makes videos on YouTube. Okay. So she made a video talking about what product managers do. The first thing she said was being able to make decisions. Like she said, that is like, you're a number one skill. Like she said, there are many things, though, but that the first thing, you need to be able to make decisions. When other people cannot make a decision, they will literally be looking at you. And you need to make a decision and you need to have a reason why you're making that decision.
you know, one of my old bosses mentioned something. She said one of the key skills of a product manager is your ability to think on your feet. You are standing there in front of your stakeholders and they're throwing you questions that you did not plan for. You should be able to think something out and give out a very viable solution. And if you have data in your hands at that point in time, you should be able to put data together and get a solution. Everybody really wants to. Like, somehow, you are not the savior, but so everybody look out to you like a savior, sort of. Yeah.
Wow, but that sounds like a lot. So this person, Chloe Shi, she also said product management is a thankless job. That her manager actually told her that if the product fails, it's your fault.
Yeah.
But if it succeeds, it's everybody's.
Exactly.
Wow. Do you believe that's accurate for you?
I believe that solely. You know, there's this popular saying that product managers are CEOs of product. I don't believe that in any way. But I believe product managers are leaders without authority.
Right? I would agree.
They lead. They don't have authority to do some certain things, but even at that, they are leader. So, and what happens to a leader? The role of a leader is actually to prevent other people from failing. Like, you can't stop them from failing. Don't get me wrong, right? But you do everything to lead people to success. And what happens when the system fails? All fingers point to the leader. Even if it's not the leader's fault, all fingers will
always point. God, I beg you.
Yeah, that's right. So as a program manager, you're just a leader. You are a leader, but you don't have authority over some certain things. So if everybody wins, it's one band, one sound. But if everything fails, you're on your own.
God, I beg. So those times when things fail, has that happened with you? Do you have any stories you can tell? You know, what would you say is like your most notable loss?
I've had failure stories, right? One of the stories I think I can remember right now is the first product role I assume officially, which is in that same company that we used to sit. There's some decisions we made that weren't making sense. And 2017, we ran out of funds, and everybody packed their bag and went home.
Wow.
Right? All because of, and the main reason was, we are so passionate about the product we are building that we did not consider pricing as a factor. Right.
Wahala.
So,
Wahala.
While we build a product, people use this product for like almost 2 years, and we're not generating any revenue. We're just self-funding,
You ain't charging for it.
No, we're not charging for it. We're self-funding.
People right? are so rich. So rich. Right? Wow.
Funny enough, it was 100% bootstrap. No.
Wow.
No. No angel investor, nobody, no family and friends. We literally were putting our money together to get things moving, right?
Okay.
So at the end of the day, we failed, and I took the fall personally. The reason I took the fall is I was supposed to know that great products are great because people are ready to part ways. They're ready to part ways with their money so they can actually together value. At the end of the day, they love what we're doing. But again, in retrospect, we realized that most of these guys were ready to actually pay good amounts of money for what for the solution we're providing to them.
Well.
Right? But we believe we must build a perfect, we thought we needed to build a perfect product before we could even charge them for it. So at the end of the day, we failed. Yeah.
So you just mentioned something that I've even been looking for the right person to ask this question. Now you have entered into the hot seat with me. So you just said something. You know, people loved what you were doing, the way you were building, and then you even won the innovation award, right? Do you think that innovation always means value? So for instance, do you think because something is innovative, people would definitely always want to pay for it?
No. So innovation will remain innovation, value will remain value, right? No matter how innovative you are, if your innovation is not solving people's problems, they're not going to pay for it, right? Nir Eyal, one of my favorite product psychology guys, said something. It literally categorized products into two. Right? He said, your product can either be a painkiller or a vitamin. Right? And if your product does not fall in any of those two categories, nobody's going to pay for it. Customers are ready to pay anything to relieve their pains. Right? But customers are ready to part ways with something interesting, but not anything, for them to have multivites in their system. Right, people will pay more attention to receiving medical treatment when they are very sick. Right, than going for a regular routine checkup. If it is routine checkup, I might miss my routine checkup today and say, okay, you know what? I'll see my doctor tomorrow. Right, and nothing's gonna happen. And I'll see my doctor tomorrow, nothing will happen. But if there's maybe some excruciating pain somewhere, I don't think I will say, hey, you know what? Don't worry, I'll see my doctor tomorrow. I'll definitely want to see the doctor. Not just today.
Like
right
immediately.
Now. Yeah. Immediately. You understand? Mm-hmm. So if I innovate and what I'm innovating is decorative, it doesn't mean anything to anybody.
Yeah. You probably just have a badge like, oh yeah, it's possible to do this.
Exactly. But how do you really convert it to revenue? So that's it. Yeah.
Amazing. This thing you just said, have you watched this movie on Netflix called Painkiller?
I think so. I'm not too big on movies like that, but hopefully I might have watched it. I don't usually remember the titles of movies and stuff.
Okay. It was about this, I can't remember the name of the drug, but then there was this drug in America, as usual. Sorry, Americans. Basically, it was a, what they call them, like a drug company, and then they basically created a drug that kills pain, that takes away people's pain. Basically, heroin, Sha. And then they packaged it and reselling it as painkillers. And then people were getting it. At first, it works. But then the thing is, you will need more and more and more. And then the pain will be seeming like times 100 if the painkiller is. So basically, they start getting addicted to it. So it's a really good movie, actually. And it's based on a true story.
Yeah, and you know, that's actually how products are supposed to. That's actually how products currently work. I always, there's a book, I mentioned Larry Ayala already, right? There's a book I would always recommend people to read from Neil Ayal. It's called, I just forgot the title. I remember the title shortly, right? Hooked.
Oh, should
yes,
I search for it quickly? Hooked. Okay.
The title is Hooked. Yes. How to build products users would, as in, and users would all use or something like that. But the title is Hooked by Neil Ayal. It actually talks about this principle, how to get your users. And I literally tested some of the things he mentioned out. By asking people, what is the first thing you do when you wake up? And I realized most people literally pick up their phone. As they're waking up, the first thing they do is their phone. Then the next question is, what do you do? Is it that they check their notification or they go ahead and open a particular social media application on their phone? You understand?
God, am I in this boat?
Yes, virtually almost everybody on the boat. I saw a data, somebody shared data, some data with me yesterday, and in that collection of data, I realized that in as much as there's campaign against driving and as in using your mobile phone while you're driving.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. 88% of drivers still use their mobile phones while driving.
Yeah.
It's addiction. Right, okay. Is addiction. And the people that are building the product on these devices, they are aware of it and they are intentional about it. Right? So, yeah, so that's, I just use that to refer to your painkiller story.
The key takeaway is when you are building a product, build a painkiller, basically. That's the key takeaway.
Of course. That's it.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. So I was hoping you would say, oh yeah, I'm a big Netflix fan. I'm always on Netflix, blah, blah. So that I will know that at least I'm on the right path to success too with all my Netflix watching. So what do you do for like work-life balance if you're not always on Netflix like me?
Okay. So basically I have this personal philosophy. If work is not fun, then it's not worth working.
Wow, let me quote, let me write that. That would be a quote from you.
So I believe no matter how hard the job is, it should be fun to do. So what I do basically is because I also, and what I try to do is to keep me focused, right? And to keep me having fun at work. I infuse play all around everything I do. So that makes things work quite better for me. And outside of that, once I started noticing burnout, right, I stay off. I abandon. I jump the boat.
Oh, nice.
I leave what I'm doing 100%.
Wow.
I leave it 100%. Okay, I think the latest one I did was, okay, so now this one is exceptional. This one is very exceptional. The latest one I did was 6 months.
Wow. Were you doing other things at that time?
Yeah, that's when I started writing. That's why I jumped into writing. That's when I started writing my blog and stuff, right?
Mm.
But outside of that, if it is just for a short period, sometimes it can just be 2 days, 3 days. I just neglect everything. And I pick some of the things I love doing. I do, I'm an amateur photographer. So I do a lot of abstract photography. You can see some of my work on Unsplash. You can see some of them on, you can see them on Unsplash. You can see them on some of these free stock images. Just search for GNRJOSE on those platforms, right?
Okay.
Yeah, Pixels, Unsplash. These are some of the places I put some of my pictures, right?
Okay. Oh my God, the pictures are beautiful. I'm looking at them right now, including the one on your head. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So those are some.
You did belly.
Yeah.
Belly and chicken. Nice.
Yeah. So those are some of my shots. Then I also take out time. I listen to a lot of music. So everywhere you see me with my headset. Everywhere. Whether it's fitting or not, I'll carry my headset with me. Then I also spend time. I love travels too. I travel once. Okay. Sometimes I just decide to travel, visit new places. Yeah. And yeah, so majorly that's it.
Fantastic. I actually agree with you. I also have this period where I'm like, no, I'm not doing anything related to this for the whole of today. But then you do something else and you realize that when you get back to, you know, your work, you feel more refreshed. You're even maybe something that, you know, you were dragging that was taking like 2 weeks. You can probably achieve it in like 2 hours now and everything is just great.
Exactly.
I love that. So your photography, why are you not charging for it? That's what I want to know.
Okay, so it's something I'm just doing for fun, right? Okay. I think I got more satisfaction in the fact that people see my pictures and like, oh, that's so beautiful. And by the way, I took most of those pictures with my Pixel phone. Again.
Okay, so this is free advertisements for them. Oh my God. Wow.
Most of them, all, but most of them. Yeah.
This is fantastic.
Yeah, so I do that. I don't charge for them because I just have fun. I enjoy more people coming around to say, hey, I love those pictures, right? Than how much money they were actually paying for it.
Fantastic. I really, really love them. Do you have any idea how many people use, I think Unsplash tells you, right? How many times it's been downloaded?
On Unsplash, I still got my analytics data today. For the month, I've not uploaded in a while, right?
Okay.
But from the few ones I've uploaded, how much was it again? I have to go and check. I can't remember, but I got for last month, I think I have close to 3,000 or 4,000 plus views on my old pictures.
Wow.
Yeah. So I have 2,706 views, I have 25 downloads, and I have 4 users.
Fantastic.
Within the past 30 days of September.
Wow, amazing stuff. Unsplash used to figure out a way to get monetization for people who are actually doing photography as kind of a hobby. I don't know, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's a very good way. It's a very good way, right? I don't believe that my photos are good enough yet for me to plug into that program. That's why I'm not plugged into it. So when
is a monetization on Unsplash. I didn't know that.
I think Pixel, either Pixel or Splash actually have monetization program and plugins. And your pictures become available just as exclusive. Only paid members
can use them.
The download, you have some fee. I think another one has a program where you can just donate and give to the photographer if you like the picture.
Oh, yeah, I think Unsplash does that. Yeah, fantastic stuff. Awesome. So amidst all your photography work, what would you say is like your biggest achievement? It could be about photography. It could be about products. You know, what would you say is your biggest achievement?
My biggest achievement would be when I built my first banking as a service platform.
Oh, I have to clap for you because it goes amazing.
Yeah. So because what really pushed me to start Baz, as in to venture into Baz and API product, I was job hunting.
Okay.
I was working in this organization, I was not really feeling it. So I started job hunting, I went online, and I saw this UK company, and they do banking as a service. I read about it. I was like, that's interesting, right? So they're looking for product manager, I applied. They gave me homework, I did the homework. They love the homework. The only challenge with my own work based on their feedback was that the figures I was quoting on my this thing is not realistic. Like, they are too small for market size. So the market size.
Okay.
So literally, I was looking at Nigerian market size. I was sizing based on Nigerian market size. But they are looking at European market size. So you can see the big difference. So they're looking forward to someone that has that have better scope in terms of market sizing and stuff like that. So that was it. That's how I missed the opportunity. Then a few weeks later, the CEO of one of the one of the earlier banking as a service platforms in Nigeria. I started tweeting and tweeting and tweeting. I started following this guy. One day I just made up my mind, like, you know what? Worst case, he would tell me no. I went to his DM. I was like, okay, I like what you guys are doing. I like to work with you.
I love that.
Yeah. And that was it. Like, literally, oh, that was it. And he was like, he gave me an email address. I should send my resume. I sent my resume.
Okay.
In less than 1 week, I got interviewed by the HR, CTO, and other people, top guys in the company. In less than 1 week after then, I got an offer. We started negotiating pricing. I was like, oh, really? Just like that. But the background is this. I have no deep knowledge about BaaS as at that time. So the fact that I was able to charge the organization, right, help build out their BaaS product from ground up and see it till it was launched was,
that's
you know,
because
it fits up like, you know what? Mm-hmm. Man, this is something that is not common out here, right? BaaS is not common in this point. And we're able to build out something and it's very developer friendly and stuff like that. So like, oh yeah, that's nice. So every day up to now, I think my next biggest achievement would be my current role. And I won't say anything about that yet until when I launched that particular product I'm working on.
So I'll be hiding at the corner of your LinkedIn waiting for you to update us on your current role.
Most likely in the next couple of months, I should announce the product, right? The launch of the product.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So you just talked about banking as a service. Can you walk us through what is banking as a service for people who don't know anything about it? What does it mean?
Okay. Yeah. So I'm looking for a very good way to tell this story. So banking as a service actually is, it's this way. It's a way banks exposes their services, right, to businesses, or the way banks allow businesses to offer banking solutions to their own customers. Not to the bank customers, now that's to the business's customers. And look at it this way. I think I have an article on my blog where I said, BaaS, HNC banking on steroids. That actually explains
it. Yes, I saw that.
You know, now we have, agency banking is not something new. I can walk down the street and see, for Nigerians, they know the people they call malams, right? A malam corner shop. For the Kenyans, there's something they call mama mboga, right? Or mama mboga's corner shop somewhere.
Okay.
Or basically just a small street shop, corner shop there. The person is selling petty stuff, petty provisions, right? But at the same time, the person has a, in Kenya, they call it PDQs. In Nigeria, we call it POS terminals, right? So probably the person has a PDQ or a POS terminal, whichever claim it is. The person does collection. The person does payments. The person sells utility services, right? So I can literally bank my cash with that person without visiting a bank branch. I can literally withdraw from my bank without visiting a bank branch, right? I can buy utility. I can make transfers from my account to another person's account without necessarily visiting a bank branch, right? Now look at it. Look at that particular service from an infrastructure standpoint. So instead of using the mama and boga in the corner shop or the malam at the corner shop, right? We are saying that businesses, proper businesses, airlines, right? Transport companies, mobile phone companies, mobile phone operators, right? Samsung, Google, Apple, all of them begin to offer banking services to their customers. That's what banking as a service is all about. So they plug into the banking infrastructure, right? And they extend the services of the bank to their own customers. And that's why today the biggest new bank is Apple. Apple runs the biggest bank, a new bank in the world. But in the real sense, they are not a bank.
Yeah, so why do you think banking as a service is becoming more relevant, more important?
Okay, I had a presentation a couple of weeks ago, and here's my story. I didn't grow up in the big cities of Nigeria. I grew up in a remote town in Nigeria. And actually I need to travel up to about 40 or 50 kilometers to access banking services where I grew up. And as at the age of 12, when I wrote my first line of code, it will be surprising to you that I've not visited a bank. Right. So I wrote my first line of code before I ever visited a bank. And before I have access to banking services. That's because it was difficult for me to access a bank. Now, on the flip side of the story, I have a nephew who is also 12 now. He's in the same shoes. He grew up in the city, or he's growing up in the city, but he himself has not visited a bank ever. The difference between the two of us, he has accessed more banking services, right, within the short period than I access bank services my first 20 years. Right?
Interesting.
And how is he accessing those banking services? Not necessarily because he has a banking app, no, but because he has several apps that is running on his phone, right, that provides him banking services without necessarily being a bank. Right?
Very interesting.
The new generation are not looking forward to visiting a bank. I think there was a survey that was carried out, and in that survey, I have people say for the past 1 year, they've not visited a bank branch. Right? For myself, I can't remember the last time I had cash transactions. Literally, I'm always without cash. If you meet me anywhere, I say, hey, please, can I get 100 naira or 1,000 naira? Like, I'm sorry, I don't have cash. Not because I don't want to give you, but because actually I don't have cash. Right? So how do I enjoy some of these services? I enjoy these services through extended banking services across platforms. Yeah. So that's why banking as a service is becoming relevant. So traditional banks have the trust. Traditional banks have the infrastructure. They have the technology. They have a lot of things, right? But they don't have the capacity to actually reach out to the real users of the banking services. So the best option for them is to extend their services to other businesses that these people are actually relating with. And those people consume those services. And at the end of the day, indirectly, they are banking with the traditional bank.
That's so interesting. So, to be honest, my mind is even blown. But I want to ask something. So, you talked about how Apple is one of the biggest new banks out there. To bring it home, can you tell us how exactly that works? Like, what are the real-world examples on this?
Okay, yeah. So, as of today, for people that are using Apple, I'm not a fan of Apple, sorry.
Why are we collecting shots? God, I beg.
So, for people that are using Apple, there's this Apple Pay feature where you can actually buy now and pay later sort of thing, right? It's a banking service. So, I break down banking, what banks do, into two broad categories. The job of the bank is to make money available to the users. And they can do that in two ways. They can provide what I call future into the now, or they can also provide you now into the future. And what I mean by future into the now? Future into the now is the money I'm supposed to have access to in the future, they make it available to me now at a price. Right? And that's where stuff like lending actually comes in. Right? The second option is now into the future. So the money I have now, I don't want to spend it. I want it to be available for use in the future. So in that way, I either save my money in the bank or I invest my money. But whichever way it is, what I have right now, they are making it available for me in the future. So banks would either provide you a now into the future or a future into the now service through financing, right? What Apple has plugged into is, you know what? Bring your money and save it on your Apple Pay wallet, right? Now that Apple Pay wallet is connected into the bank account space system, right? So when I put my money, when I put $5 or $10 or $100 in my Apple Pay wallet, the money is sitting in the bank. It's not sitting with Apple. It's actually, it's literally sitting in the bank.
Yeah.
Now, if I have $100 and I need to pay for my, so let's say within the past 1 year, I've been buying my iCloud storage consistently. I've been doing some other things. So I've been buying apps. I've been subscribing for this, subscribing for that. And at the end of the day, I have, I'm short. I need this month, I need to spend about $150. But because I've been doing that consistently, Apple have insights into my expenses. Apple would say, hey, you know what? You want to spend $150? Go ahead and spend the $150 without affecting your position in the bank. Because they are sure that I'm going to come back and pay that money. So they've been able to give me feature into the now. The money I'm going to make in the future, they already provided for me now to access the service I need. So they are basically carrying out the duty of a bank, right? Without being a bank. Again, through the bank to the bank customers.
Fantastic.
So if you use Apple Pay today, you are actually the customer of a particular bank in the US. Even if you've never visited the US before.
Interesting. That's very interesting. Have you considered being a lecturer? Because you're literally explaining this so well in a way I've never even understood.
I hate teaching. I love discussion. I love discussions when I teach. Yeah.
Fantastic. So that's really insightful. You basically explained to us the pipeline, right? So in your role, right, what are like the biggest challenges to getting this service, this thing, this whole pipeline to happen? What are the biggest challenges?
My God, the biggest challenge actually is compliance.
Hey, I wanted to say, it has to be. Everywhere, roadblocks.
Compliance, right? And actually, compliance itself is not a problem, right? Mm. Or let me say compliance. I think the biggest, compliance is not a problem. Regulation is the problem.
Regulation, mm-hmm.
Right? And regulation itself is not supposed to be the problem. It is more around how regulation is being introduced in this client, in this part of the world, right? So you have, for example, you sleep last night, you've implemented, you've launched, your customers are enjoying your service, you slept last night. And as you're waking up 7 o'clock this morning, nothing has happened. You're dressing up for work, 8 o'clock, as I'm hitting the office by 8:30 or 9 o'clock. You just get a circular memo. Memo from the central bank, or memo from another regulatory body here and there, different regulatory bodies. Mm. Everybody just come up and they're telling you, you have just 24 hours or 48 hours to shut down a particular service to comply. Exactly. So, oh, for God freaking sake, you understand?
Hey.
Now, you shut down that service. How do I truly meet my customers' needs? Customers will not understand, right? A very major case is actually a Nigerian case where all of a sudden they just wake up and say you cannot spend more than $100 a month on your Naira card. And from $100 went down to
$20.
From 20, they just come back, they just clear everything up.
Oh, God.
Right? So, how do you actually explain that? In this case, I had a family friend who was in the US. This guy went to a boutique. He was shopping, preparing to come back. He has selected everything he wanted to pay. This is a guy that could spend over $1,000 at a go. He has picked everything he wanted to pay. And lo and behold, transaction declined. I was happy because it was a boutique. Right? Mm. Imagine it was a restaurant.
You have to wash plates. My God. My God. At least you could just return the attendant. But that is actually...
You understand? So, it's pretty difficult navigating regulatory processes in Africa, I'll say that, majorly in Africa. But outside of that, I think it's generally fun building a bank. And the fact that I can extend a service, the fact that I can bank customers without spending so much in banking them, right? Yeah, so those are some of the things that actually make a lot of sense to me.
Wow. So you earlier you talked about, you know, the Kenyan space, and then you just mentioned how, you know, regulation in Africa. So would you say, I mean, have you built products for Kenya? And if you have, would you say they also face similar issues like we do in Nigeria in terms of regulation?
Yes, so I would think, I would say this, I think regulations is quite more elaborate in Nigeria. Some people might say otherwise, but from my own understanding, I think Nigerian regulation is more open from the short experience I had with the Kenya regulators, right? I would say that Nigeria is more open compared to those other countries, compared to many African countries. And Nigeria is still very far, very, very far from me. Very, very far from me. Yeah.
Okay. So we always hear this term, regulatory sandbox. Supposedly we have that in Nigeria. How do you think that's working out? Or how is it working out in your experience? The smile on your face, I wish I could put it in this. I wish I could encapsulate it in this podcast.
So for the regulatory sandbox, I think the Nigerian's regulatory sandbox is more of cheap political, what is it called? They call it political something. Like, they just want to win some
points,
cheap political score. Yeah, political point. Yeah, cheap political points compared to what's actually supposed to do. Since the sandbox has been announced, up till today, I've not really seen anything moving forward, right? So I think whoever was in charge wanted to do that to just gain some, either get some political points or use it to distract people from the real incidents that's happening behind the scenes.
Yeah. So
apologies,
I mean,
apologies to regulators, and I hope they will not come for me.
No, but they can educate us. If something is actually going on that we are not aware of, this is a fantastic point now to them to know that they need to educate us. They need to let us know what's actually happening, how we can be involved in the regulatory sandbox. But from my point of view, it just seems like there's just a shell of a thing called regulatory sandbox somewhere, but we're actually not participating. Fantastic.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you. So you talked about how, you know, in your role, you are basically bringing banking services from traditional banking to the consumers, even though you are not working with consumers directly, right? What would you say is the role of APIs in getting this to happen? And can you explain to us how APIs, you know, how important APIs are in your role?
Okay, so there's this very popular example that people usually use, the restaurant example for APIs. But I prefer to use something more homegrown than restaurant, right? So you have a two-year-old. Definitely, you don't want to leave your two-year-old to handle some things like your gas cooker, right? You don't want your two-year-old to play around or to make things with 100-degree boiling water, right? So what actually happens? In the kitchen, you store a lot of things inside your kitchen. You have your tea, you have a lot of things stored everywhere in your kitchen. And use that storage like your database, right? Now, your two-year-old wants to go to school in the morning, and the two-year-old will say, "Mommy, I want to take hot tea this morning." You are the mother. Now, in this case, the mother is the API, right? The kitchen is like the engine, the room where the core application is running. That's where the database is and a lot of things. So the child makes a request for a glass of tea. You get into the kitchen as the mother, as the API. You are the API. She has placed a request. You get into the kitchen. When you make the tea and everything, now you send that request to the kitchen, actually. And in the kitchen, the chef is there to make the tea. The chef pours the water, makes the tea, do everything, put it in a cup. You take that tea that the chef has made in the kitchen back to the child in the dining area. Now, that food that you take, that drink that you, or that tea that you take back to the child is what we call response. Right? Now, the child takes that tea. That is consummation of API, right? When the child takes that tea, the child is satisfied and life goes on. That's basically how API works. The chef in the kitchen knows where the tea is stored. He knows where the milk is. He knows where the sugar is. He knows where the kettle is, right? Firing up the stove, the teapot or whatever to make the tea is actually more like the logical function that happens in your application engine. He knows the right temperature, right? And everything for it to boil and stuff. So basically, that's how API works. So the child does not need to know the complexities of how things happen in the kitchen. The child only knows that I need to wait for 5 minutes and I'm going to have my well-brewed tea, right? And it's going to take it. So that's how API works. And the same way is how banking as a service also works, right? So the fintech or the business that is using banking as a service only makes a request. They make requests through API to the bank internally. So the internal controls are in the bank. Most of these actions are fully automated. The internal controls are there. The compliance guys are there. The auditors are there. Everybody is there. The settlement and reconciliation guys are there. So when the fintech guy, when the customer of the business makes a request, right, the business pushes that request to the bank. The bank's own infrastructure processes all of that, send back a response to the business or the fintech, and that fintech or business sends the response back to the consumer. So basically, that's how banking as a service works.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Isaac, you still do lecturing. You will go to your alma mater. You will go to your alma mater and lecture. when it happens, just remember that I'm doing that. I told you. Interesting. So you've really broken it down. Now, yeah. I think anyone listening can definitely understand better. So what would you... I saw your blog post about the life cycle of APIs, right? Yeah. And you highlighted the life cycles. But what would you say is like the most important thing we would need to know? So if we want to... use APIs in our work as a product manager, what would you say is the most important thing you need to know?
Oh, okay. So I think the first thing to actually know about APIs is you don't just build APIs and consummate APIs because they are available for you to build and consummate, right? You don't just request for anything in the kitchen because it's available in the kitchen, right? If I request for a request for baking soda and I'm in the dining area, a request for baking soda and what's it called again? Baking soda, and because I know baking soda is there, then I also request for bleach and I said they should mix it for me and give me to eat. Definitely voila. That's poison.
Yeah.
You understand, right? So I need to understand first of all what is the problem I'm trying to solve. If the problem I'm trying to solve is the problem of hunger, then let me request for food. If the problem I'm trying to solve is the problem of thirst, then I'll request for a drink. But if I don't understand the problem I'm trying to solve and I just place a request, then at the end of the day, it might not do me well. So the most important thing about consummating API is first of all to understand what problem we are trying to solve. When we understand the problem we are trying to solve, we move on to now looking out for which of these API services best fit into what I want to do. And there are a lot of factors to consider when it comes to fit, right? In terms of access, ease of access, right? In terms of scalability, I need to understand, is it scalable enough for what I want to do? Is it accessible to me? In terms of cost, how expensive is it? Right? is it very expensive? There are some APIs, personally, I will not even touch them right now because the cost is very high. Currently, I'm working, I think I dropped an article some 2 days ago on API monetization, how to make money from your API. I dropped the part one of the article and I'm going to drop the part two. And we're going to begin to see, do I need to subscribe to this API? Or is that the one that pays me better? Or the one that's actually charging me per API call? Or the one that provides me freemium service? Or, you know, there are different ways. There are different ways you can actually talk about API monetization. So how much will this actually cost me is also a very important thing to consider, right? Yeah.
Yeah, so all these considerations are things you as a product manager need to know. And I'm finding that difficult to understand how you're able to work with all these things happening. So regulations, you have to have an open mind about that. You have to have an open mind about, how much how scalable is this API? How much will it cost if I decide I want to implement it? Or what's even happening on the consumer landscape? Would maybe the neobank or whatever I'm trying to do this for, would they actually be able to afford this, right? So all these considerations are a lot. What would you say is, how would you say someone who is interested in the space can become more knowledgeable about it? Are there any courses or things like that that they can do? You know, what would you recommend?
Okay, so courses are great, right? I think I wrote an article sometimes back where I talked about mentors and coach. And there's a line I actually wrote there I would like to quote. It's actually one of my most favorite lines in all the articles I've been writing. That line is, I said, you learn how to write. So you watch YouTube videos and you read books, learning how to ride a bicycle, right? But the day you're given a bicycle to ride, what happens? You discover that all the knowledge you've gathered from your YouTube and this thing sometimes comes very useless because nobody taught you how to balance on the bicycle. So most of the times, you actually get these things done by getting your hands dirty. Personally, hey. I'm more hands-on. I like to try my hands on it. If I don't get it right, I want to go back and try it again, right? And the first API product I ever built was not necessarily very successful. I had headaches, I had issues because I was trying to understand how API works while I was still building. But over time, it becomes more like, because I've done it over and over and over and over and over again, it becomes, I just know what to look up. So for people that want to transition, one of the key things I would recommend is, one, get your hands dirty. And two, don't get a mentor, get a coach.
That is very insightful.
Get a coach. It's very important, right? Because coach would actually handhold you. A mentor will not handhold you. A mentor is literally there to just give you pointers. He's not going to handhold you, right? But a coach would actually show you how to get things done. So that's one of the key things to do. Courses are very good and they're very important. They give you insights and they give you pointers as well. But know that courses are for knowledge purposes, not necessarily practical ability most times. However, there's this course I recommend to people that are already building. There's this API certification course that I always recommend. It's quite boring, a course, but there's this particular API certification course I'm trying to remember. API Academy, right? There's this platform called apiacademy.co. So people can go there and take some of those API certification courses to have a knowledge of. Right. Yeah. And also, it's also very important that to be an API product manager, you have to be technical. You can't tell me, I'm sorry, I don't like all those technical stuff. You have to, even if you don't write code, right? You have to understand all these nuances very well. It's a must before you can actually build out API products. Yeah.
That was actually going to be my next question. So now, after this, the next question is, how technical is technical? And is there even an answer to this question?
How technical is technical? Yeah, how technical, like, you can be as technical as you want. right? So basically, the interesting thing about product management is you are this guy that, you know, when they say that when you're in Rome, behave like the Romans, right? Yeah, product managers are typical examples of that.
Okay.
And what I mean is, when I'm talking with business stakeholders, you forget that I actually have an understanding of technical jargon. I'm talking to them in business terms. I'm speaking business terminologies. Mm. I'm talking like I've been a business guy for the past 500 years, right? And when it's time for me to talk to engineers, I'm talking to my engineers like, I can write all the codes in this world, even if I don't know how to write Hello World, right? So it's very important. So as a product manager, you are not a, when it comes to technicalities, you are not a doer of technicalities, but you are actually a, you are knowledgeable enough, you are a pointer, you are giving them pointers to this is what we're doing. And also, it's very important to also note that you are not a, you don't know it all. Right? And because you know that you don't know it all, it's very important for you to be ready to listen. Just be patient to listen to your engineers. You're not a taskmaster. And you're not a backlog keeper. Right? You are there to provide solutions. So basically, I always tell my team members, I'll say, hey, my job here as a product manager is to help you remove every form of blockers. If there are blockers, I'm here to clear those blockers for you so you can work, so you can focus. If an engineer is having issues, listen to an engineer. Let the engineer explain the issue to you. From there, you begin to learn. If you don't understand and you don't want to disturb him, go online. Go and read about it. Come back and ask him questions. What's an API gateway? How does an API... So you don't want to sit to an engineer and say, explain to me how API gateway works. But when your engineer is talking and say, you know, we need to have some API gateway integrations, blah, 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 blah. And you don't want to ask him, or you know you cannot even ask him, what's an API gateway? How does API gateway work? You can ask him, what's an API gateway? He's going to explain to you, but he won't take time to start explaining to you how API gateway works. Then go online, go and check how API gateway works. Go and read about it. I have one favorite website, howstuffwork.com. I go to that website a lot, and I learn a lot from it. From life to sciences to technology to data to anything, right? Yeah, so those are some of it. Then, yeah, ChatGPT is also a very good teacher. I'm not saying to do your work. I'm saying to learn. Most times I just go on ChatGPT and ask questions. What is this? How does this work? Explain to me like a five-year-old how this works. And it explains to me and I have a better understanding. So when I come and I explain something, it's like, man, this guy. No, I've actually taken time to read the explanation to a child before here.
Fantastic stuff. So I really like how you just shared this, howstuffworks.com. I'm going to be there now. Now that I have said it, I'm going to be there every day. Fantastic stuff. So you mentioned something a little bit earlier. You said how, you know, you cannot learn how to ride a bicycle just from watching YouTube videos or if someone just tells you, right? At the end of the day, when you get on the bicycle, you now realize that, wait, though, yeah, they say I should pedal, but something is happening. There's some kind of force that's not making me stay in a straight line, right? You can't figure out how to balance. So you're basically telling us that all these things happen on the field. Like, when the gun is pointed at you, that's when you learn, right? But then do you think that businesses, organizations are ready for that level of experimentation where you are basically learning on the job? And how, like, what can someone actually do to, you know, I don't know, learn faster? What are the ways that can you, just to survive, basically?
So here's a very sad truth, right? One of the reasons why I would always recommend to anybody, even before you start your enterprise, to go and work somewhere is you are literally paid to learn. No matter the level of job, even if you are the CEO, or even if you are the MD of a company, and you are an employee, you are paid, you are always paid to learn whatever it is you are doing, right? The only challenge comes where you are coming with, I don't know. You're not coming with an open mind to learn how things are done, right? So when I'm there, first of all, let's say I just want to transition into building API products, or my organization is trying to build API product, right? I want to start, which is a major challenge we have in the tech space now in Africa, right? You have no experience and you want to be earning like someone that's been there for 10 years. It doesn't work.
Oh my God. So, yeah, unrealistic expectations.
Unrealistic expectation. I don't mind taking, personally, I don't mind taking a pay cut because I know there's a knowledge gap I need to fill. Once I'm done filling that knowledge gap, I've moved. And I'm taking, my next pay raise is not just going to be just pay raise. It's going to be significant pay raise. But I'm actually, you understand, it's not going to be a plus 10, it's going to be a 10x, you understand? Mm-hmm. Or X10 kind of thing. So like, it's important for people to realize that, hey, this thing that I am doing, am I here to learn? Am I here to add knowledge to what I have? Or I'm here to add to what the position has? So don't want to come in as a senior product manager when you don't have the knowledge of product management.
And now you're setting yourself up for the firing squad.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And also be open, always be open. Be open to learn. Because see, the only people that make it alive are people that are ready to learn. Even when it seems as if they know it all, they are still open to learning. They will always excel. And the good thing about 9 to 5, they will always pay you for that thing that you are learning. You will always be paid for it. The organization will pay you for learning. For because you are even open, right? You get promoted faster. You move up the ladder faster. Yeah.
I definitely agree with that. So you just said, and I'm going to quote you. You said, as an employee, an MD, whoever you are literally paid to learn. And I think that's very valid. And I hear there are organizations that don't even promote learning, don't create an environment for learning, right? And I think at that point, you just have to take the learning into your own hands. Right. So that's really valid. I appreciate that. So I can let you go. You can round up in next. I have two more questions for you. So one of them is in the future, you know, everybody's trying to make predictions. They let us know where to invest our money. Let us know whether we should jackpot, you know, what's going on. What would you say is the future trajectory for BaaS, for banking as a service? Is that, what do you think we would expect to see in the next maybe like 2 to 3, 5, 4, 5 years? And then what trends should we also be on the lookout for?
Okay, so banking as a service is actually something that is built like, is like a step forward from open banking, right? And after banking as a service, after open banking, the next thing we are talking about is open finance. And the bridge between open banking and open finance is actually banking as a service. So I'm literally looking forward to that maturity where open finance becomes a standard. Right? Then from there, we know what next we need to do. But I know that the ultimate at the end of everything is open data. Open data is the end game for everybody, where we have access to, unrestricted access to data, without killing people's privacy, right? So how do we actually implement open finance properly beyond just open banking? What's next on the horizon for open finance? And how is banking as a service going to take us there? I think those are some of the most important thing we need to look out for right now in the system.
Okay, fantastic. So what would this mean for every one of us, you know, when there's open data, when there's open finance? That open data you're talking about, some people don't want to hear anything like that. They feel like everything is a data breach, a privacy breach. I still saw something today on Twitter. Someone said on TikTok, he was getting this notification to follow his contacts, but he had switched that, privacy setting off, yes. So people are now explaining to him that his friends who didn't switch off that feature, that's how TikTok gets information.
So the feature, you're asking how open data is going to look like. So now let me give you a very good example. Today, if you want to build out a new business, it's quite difficult for you to get access to data, right? If I ask you today, how many Nigerians, or how many, okay, let me say, how many liters of milk do we consume today, per day, per person in Nigeria? What's the average volume of milk we consume per person per day in Nigeria today? Most likely you don't have an answer to that.
No way. I know where to get the answer. You go on statistics, that it's not there. You can even go and beg pick milk. It's not there. You can go and beg nap that. It's not there.
It's not there. So at the end of the day, how do we actually have all this data if we don't have a way of collating all the data? And remember when I was talking earlier, I talked about without breaching people's data privacy, right? So I can literally know that in Nigeria today, we can literally know how much money has been transferred from transfers from one account from accounts all through the country, right? Because those transfers happen electronically. And when CBN wants to release that data, they're not going to say, oh, Isaac transferred X amount to Iwa, right? Sorry, I prefer calling you Iwa, right?
No, that's fine, yeah.
Okay, so like, it was Isaac transferred X amount to Iwa, right? But they have the total sum of money that has been transferred in between customers across board. And they come out and say, daily in Nigeria, so trillion naira or so billion naira, it's been transferred, right? And every year in, year out, we have this surge, this particular period of the year in terms of electronic transfers. However, government cannot necessarily account for money that exchanges hands, like cash, paper money, paperback cash, that exchanges hands between customers. Because when I give Iwa 10,000 naira cash, the government is not there. And there's no way they can prove it. They can only estimate.
And they don't know whether I want to hide it under my mattress or if I'm going to use to buy plantain.
Exactly. So at the end of the day, they can only estimate and say, we can estimate and say maybe about 10 billion or 50 billion, 100 billion is being exchanged in terms of cash, hand to hand. But they can't really give specific. And because they can't give that figure, it even affects our government's budgets. It even affects us, how we build our products and our businesses. So that's why I said that the ultimate is from open finance, then we'll start talking about open data. And it's not something, I don't foresee it happening in the next 5 years.
So I'm drawing a lot of conclusions from what you said. Basically, what you're saying is with open data, decision-making will have evidence. There'll be evidence-backed decision-making, data-driven decision-making. People can plan better. Governments can plan better. Industries can plan better. We can even know when to be planting tomatoes. We can know when it's going to rain, things like that, right? So in oil, the world will improve. Or is that going too far?
No, definitely. It's going to improve. The world's going to improve. We're going to be able to do things better, right? Yeah, I know it also has its own downside, right? Like governments using citizens' data against them and stuff like that. But basically, that's what we're actually up to, a better world for everyone.
Fantastic stuff. So I think this is a great place to round off now. Isaac, do you have any final words for us? You know, what can we take away? If we didn't hear anything you said, maybe everything you said is one, our minds are blown. What's one thing you want us to take away from this whole episode?
Yeah, so generally, I would say be good, right? Build good products, build great products, but above all, look out for ways to solve real problems, right? Solving real problems above any other thing. And again, please, this is my blog. Read, comment, let's interact, right? And I'm open to actually sharing way more.
And that's a wrap for this episode of the Spotlight Podcast. We've had a really great chat with Isaac Durote about fintech, APIs, and product management. We hope you found this insightful. We demystified banking as a service, discussed the API product lifecycle, and examined the unique dynamics of fintech in Nigeria. Isaac has also shared insights into essential technical concepts for product managers. If you are interested in the technical aspects of these topics, this episode offers valuable insights and tips. If you're curious to learn more, do check out his blog at blog.juniorjose.org. would also love to hear your thoughts and questions, so feel free to connect with us on social media or drop us an email. Your feedback is really important and helps shape the direction of the podcast. As we wrap up this insightful conversation, remember that curiosity fuels innovation and understanding the tech landscape is really key. So until next time, stay curious, stay inspired, and stay tuned for more exciting episodes.